This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, give language a sword and a ball of thread and strict instructions not to get eaten by a minotaur. This episode is all about apologies, one of the most important verbal transactions, and perhaps one of the most challenging, because, as Elton John sang, "Hold me closer, tiny dancer." Wait, that's the wrong one. "When I was down, I was your clown." "I missed the earth so much, I miss my wife. Can you feel the love tonight? I'd buy a big house where we both could live. It seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind. Saturday, 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 Saturday." Hang on, here it is. "Sorry seems to be the hardest word." Got there in the end. I hate myself. I could apologise for it, but I did just choose to do it. So, on with the show. Sorry if you're offended. I apologise to anyone who thought I did anything racist slash sexist slash other. I regret the offence I caused. No, hang on. Let's not make it about me. I regret the offence caused. Sorry I was mean to you because you did that really annoying thing. I said I was sorry. Can I go now? It has got to be better than this.
This is Susan McCarthy. I am a writer and author. I specialize in wildlife, animal behavior, humor, and apologies.
And I'm Marjorie Ingle, and I too am a writer and author, and I too specialize in apologies.
And together they run Sorry Watch, a website and Twitter account through which, since 2012, they have been analysing the wording of public apologies and what makes them apologetic or not.
What we always wanted to do with this website was to support good apologies and make there be more of them. We don't want to live in this land of snark. I mean, we can be really snarky, but we believe in redemption, or we wouldn't want to do this.
Why do you think people are so bad at this?
I think we're not taught how to apologize, most of us. I certainly wasn't. And I think many of us don't get good examples when we're growing up, alas. And also, when you apologize, you put yourself one down, and that's just not fun. So people avoid it.
Yeah, you have to make yourself vulnerable. You have to, you know, we all want to be the hero of our own story. And apologizing means acknowledging that sometimes you're the villain in the story, in somebody else's story. And yeah, and it's funny because we all recognize a terrible apology when we hear one. And yet somehow when we're the one called onto the carpet, we all still, you know, the temptation to mess it up is very, very great.
If you apologize and you saved your pride, you probably apologized badly.
Well, Helen, I'd expect you of all people to know that etymologically, apology was a defense, no remorse or regret in it at all. So everyone who apologizes without actually expressing that they're sorry is really just acting in the tradition of the word. And this is why none of my friends talk to me anymore. The etymological life is a lonely one.
Living in Canada, we see a lot of apologies.
Yes, Britain, the same. Someone steps on your foot and you apologize for having feet. It's that kind of deal.
Yeah, you have a foot, so it's your fault.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, those kinds of apologies generally serve a different purpose than an actual, like, sincere apology. They're more to, like, ease a relationship.
This is Laura Bowden, who wrote her MA thesis on public apology and faux-pology.
This is an ongoing field of study. Like, there's no lack of material. And there's so many different ways for people to look at it. Like, I specifically look at it through the lens of linguistics and speech act theory. It's a way of breaking it down and finding a little niche to make sense of the world. A speech act is an action that is performed in the world through the language that you use. By saying certain words, you are performing an action of apology. You are repairing something.
There are certain essential components to an apology.
In order for a public apology or even an interpersonal apology to be successful, there's four conditions that have to be met. There has to be an act, like an offense done by the speaker or someone for whom the speaker is a formally recognized representative. So in a public apology, that can be, you know, the person who committed the offense, or it could be the CEO of a company that is issuing a corporate apology. In an interpersonal apology, it could be a parent apologizing on behalf of a child who can't apologize yet. The second condition is that the speaker has to believe that the apology recipient or contextually relevant third party believes that the act was an offense against the recipient. So that's a long-winded way of saying that you have to believe that the person you're apologizing to or the group that you're apologizing to deserves an apology. So you can't just say to anyone that was offended. You have to like actually believe that the person or people that you're addressing deserve an apology.
So you can't just scream it into the wind, hope it seeps into someone's soul.
Yeah. Yeah. The third condition is that the speaker regrets the act, the offensive act, or one of its consequences. And I think that this really works with public apologies, but also interpersonal apologies, because you may not regret something that you said, but you definitely regret the impact that it had on a relationship.
How does that work in practice? Because I can think of some celebrities who may not regret the action they did, but do very sincerely regret the impact that reputational damage might have on their income.
That is a consequence of the action. And that's where it kind of comes down to what's actually in the apology. Because you have to show that you actually regret the damage that you've done in some way. And it can't really be for a selfish reason.
Okay, so regret the consequences for the person to whom you're apologizing rather than the consequences to yourself.
Yes. Yeah. And then the last one is called the essential condition, and it's that the utterance counts as an apology. So you have to actually use speech strategies that show that the words that you're speaking are actually an apology. So if you mean it to be an apology and the other person accepts it to be an apology, then it counts as an apology. So it's not just, well, I said it as an apology and I mean it that way. It also has to count as an apology to the hearers. It can't be one-sided.
How to accomplish that?
You have to say what you did, and you have to say why that was bad and why they're entitled to feel bad. And you need to tell them that you're not going to do it again and make a convincing case that you're not going to do it again.
At sorrywatch.com, Susan and Marjorie have a handy six-step guide to making a meaningful apology. Step one seems obvious, but amazing how many people forget it.
Say the words, I'm sorry or I apologize. I regret? No. Regret is about how you feel. Apology and sorry are about how the other person feels.
Step two.
Say specifically what you're sorry for.
Step three.
Make it clear that you understand why you did a bad thing.
Step four.
Be really careful if you just try to explain what you did, because it's so easy for that to become an excuse for what you did. That also can mean just letting the other person have their say and taking it when they want to tell you what you did.
Step five.
Explain the actions to ensure that this will not happen again.
Step six.
And if there is a way to make reparations, make reparations.
Is there a danger if you're saying, I'm sorry for this specific thing I did to you, that you're re-traumatizing the apology recipient by detailing the offense again?
Yes. An important thing to consider is, does the person want your apology? Sometimes the intention is good to go back to the people you've harmed, but they may not want to hear from you. And if they are not up for forgiving you and you kind of know that, that's something you have to sit with. We are not comfortable sitting with our own discomfort and our own knowledge that we screwed up. And sometimes not apologizing is a form of apology.
Yeah. And you know, if you had an affair with their spouse, they might not want to hear from you, even if you feel really bad about it.
When apologizing, it is also important not to turn it into a situation where the recipient of the apology ends up having to comfort the apologizer.
One of the biggest things that bugs me is in an apology when somebody tries to align themselves with the victims. And we see this more so, I think, in celebrity apologies than in corporate or strictly political apologies, because a lot of times celebrities will say, you know, making my fans feel bad is, you know, the worst thing for me. And it's not about you in an apology. That's one that we see come up a lot. And to think that any one of you felt this way is awful to me. Poor you.
I'm sorry. It's all about me. I once had a neighbor lose her key and lean on my doorbell at 4 a.m. And when I let her in, she was like, I'm terrible. I should die in a fire. And it's like, shut up. This is, yeah.
Wow. Well, that's not going to put you back to sleep at 4 a.m. if she dies in a fire, because then there'll probably be fire brigade and everything.
I don't want to go. No, you don't deserve to die in a fire. I'm angry. You woke me up at 4 a.m. And like, you self-flagellating about it doesn't mean that you didn't ring my doorbell at 4 a.m.
Another part of the equation is who the apology is by and for. An interpersonal apology is a more straightforward transaction between apologizer and recipient, you know, individual to individual. But it gets more complicated with public apologies. For example, a celebrity apologizing to their following rather than to people they directly harmed. Or a corporation or institution or state apologizing for wrongdoing by the organization or within it.
There's definitely a difference in participant structure in a public apology than in an interpersonal apology. Because in an interpersonal apology, you are the offender and the recipient is the person who was offended. And so it's a straight line from you to the person you offended, or from the person who offended you to you. But when you get into public apologies, there are a lot of different participant roles. In a corporate apology, for example, there's 3 speaker roles. So there's the author of the apology, which may or may not be the same person that committed the offense. Usually with a corporate apology, it's part of a team that writes this. So whether it's your PR or communications department, along with the CEOs and lawyers, and often external crisis managers get called in if it's a really bad thing. And then you have the principal, which is who the apology represents, which in a corporate apology is basically the corporation as a whole. And then you have the animator, which is the person who actually performs the apology. And that's usually not the same person that committed the offense in a corporation.
I wonder how corporations choose this person. Maybe they hold auditions for whichever C-suite exec is best at sounding contrite but blameless. But if you're a head of state, you probably should be practicing apologies into a hairbrush in front of your bathroom mirror, because this might well come up. Or should.
In a lot of cases, when the government apologizes, if it's for something that happened in the past, so for example, the Canadian federal government apologized for historical offenses against LGBTQ2+ people. They apologized in 2017 for like historical oppression. Justin Trudeau apologized. And so he was the one apologizing, but he was apologizing on behalf of the Canadian federal government from the 1970s, the 1980s. So he is their formal representative, even though he and his government hadn't committed the offense.
See, that's an easier apology to make when you're not culpable.
Oh, absolutely. And some would question whether or not that apology can actually be considered a true apology. It can, depending on like the reparations going forward. But it's definitely easier for apologizing if you're apologizing for something that you didn't do. So making an apology is more of a public statement than it is a reparation.
And I guess whether that is meaningful or not is up to the recipients.
And then you also have different hearer roles in public apologies. So you have the people who were directly victims, and then you also have what we call ratified overhearers. So these would be things like the media or the general public, who you're not necessarily apologizing to, but they're also going to be receiving your apology and having an opinion on it. And that kind of differs from an interpersonal apology, because you're not going to actually get that kind of distinction.
What would you say distinguishes a good apology, a bad apology, and an apology that looks good but is bad?
Susan made up a term for that last one, which is an apology-shaped object.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different discursive strategies that are used in faux apologies that on first pass can seem like they're an apology. So if you want to give the person the benefit of the doubt, or if you're not listening, people can get away with those kinds of apologies that actually don't mean anything. And we find this a lot in public apologies. So a lot of times people will take only a little bit of responsibility. An example of that would be, my name is on the show and everything we do, and I take responsibility for that. So you're hedging the amount of responsibility you take. And so if you're hedging the amount of responsibility that you take for the offense that you're apologizing for, then it can't really be an apology.
What are some other common faux apology strategies?
Expressing ignorance, saying that you didn't know what you did was wrong. That can be a big one. And saying that it's not like me. Mm. The phrase, this is not who I am, actually comes up in a lot, or this doesn't align with my values.
But, you know, if you did it, then it is part of who you are.
Exactly. You may not want it to be part of who you are, but if you did it, then it is part of who you are.
I'm interested in some of the linguistic constructions used where people dissociate themselves or they remove agency, mm-hmm. like using adjectives instead of verbs, or using the passive voice, or like the Louis C.K. one where he was like, I have been remorseful of my actions. Like, oh, so you're not anymore. It was just a passing like 10 minutes.
Yeah, that one comes up a lot. The most common way of dissociating is through passive constructions, but there's also the strategy of what we call nominalization. And that's basically, instead of naming an action, you turn it into a noun. There was one that came up in Trudeau's apology to the Indigenous communities in Newfoundland and Labrador, where he talks about the misguided belief instead of we believed or the government believed. So by calling it a belief instead of the government believed or we believed, you dissociate yourself from it, because it basically makes it stand on its own as something else.
Passive voice also helps the apologizer to distance themselves from the offense, or be distanced from the offense.
X was done instead of I did X. It makes a big difference in your personal agency, or the agency of the person you're representing or the company that you're representing. It basically makes it seem like it was some anonymous entity that did this instead of you personally. And so it makes it easier to have this dissociation. One of the ways that people dissociate is by saying things like, this practice was prejudiced, instead of I was prejudiced. It's just a way of not taking responsibility. And so that really doesn't have any place in a successful apology. But it is one of the things that we see a lot.
Or they'll say, we're sorry that offense was caused, rather than sorry I caused offense.
Offense happened.
Out of nowhere, just appeared.
Yes.
So many ways to shuffle around words to remove the offense causer from the act of causing offense.
Wow, unfortunately this product killed a lot of people. Unfortunately, a lot of my constituents thought that I didn't think their votes counted.
Sorry, it was misinterpreted.
It's interesting, because you're supposed to take responsibility, and a lot of times people apologizing will say, I take complete responsibility. Somebody else did it while I was out of town, and the people who turned purple should have known better than to take a product without reading the directions. And step by step, they do not take responsibility.
Right. I had no idea, but the buck stops with me.
Humans are just brilliant at trying to save their pride, and they come up with the most amazing stuff. And you can say, I apologize for making you feel bad. I apologize if what I said made you feel bad. You can just get further and further away from any responsibility or culpability with either word.
Yes, the conditionals seem like the point where you should probably just end the sentence.
Correct. I had to make an apology to a friend, and I actually talked it through with Susan first because I thought I was going to mess it up. Because the tendency is so much to go, but you know, I did that because you, it's very hard to leave the you out of it. You know, it doesn't matter what they did. The apology is about what you did, even if they did something bad.
In personal apologies in particular, when you're apologizing for something, one thing that's really hard for people to do is to isolate what they're apologizing for from, in fact, the context. So, you know, you say, I am sorry I snapped at you, but you were being so annoying. It's a terrible apology. Maybe they were being so annoying, and maybe that's a thing that it would really be good to talk about with them. But when you're apologizing, it's not relevant. That ruins your whole apology.
We also dislike for any hurt caused, for anyone who was offended, because the any implies maybe it was no one.
Yeah.
And it's clear that if you're apologizing, someone was offended. Again, it's all about distancing yourself from what you did.
Yeah, and removing agency.
Yes.
If your castle is surrounded by people shouting with pitchforks and torches, and you're up on the battlements shouting, sorry if I caused any offense, you know you caused offense.
Yeah.
It can be quite a power move, though, just to admit you made the mistake.
Oh, yeah.
And that the defensiveness just makes them look worse.
It's easier to admit a mistake sometimes in an interpersonal apology, because it's generally just between like two people or within your family or friends group. But when you perform a public apology, there can be a lot more ramifications. So you could lose your career. You could lose future opportunities. But you can also like open yourself up to legal ramifications by admitting wrongdoing. And that's why a lot of public apologies are really carefully phrased.
That's one of the things that makes me crazy, is because if you actually look at the research, good research makes it very clear that taking responsibility is what people want. And saying you're sorry in, say, a medical malpractice case, you know, if it's a sorry you were harmed, without taking any responsibility for it, the recipient of the apology is vindictive, and usually rightly. And there's research about this in both legal and medical settings, that if you say you're sorry, here's what happened. We're going to meet with you face to face and talk about what we learned from this situation and how nobody else is going to go through it. Jury verdicts are smaller if it goes to trial. Often it doesn't go to trial at all. You can offer a smaller settlement. But lawyers still resist so strongly this notion of taking responsibility. And there's something in the culture that has to change.
I suppose they're being cautious because the client isn't saying something that's going to come back to bite them if they just say nothing at all.
Right. And it just makes people angrier.
So one example that I like is from Condoleezza Rice's memoir. And she actually says, we wanted to take responsibility, but we were advised not to. So instead, we expressed regret. In a typical interpersonal apology, you can say, like, I really regret hurting you. I'm not going to do it again. And that stands on its own fine as an apology. But from a legal perspective and from a strict linguistic speech act perspective, the act of expressing your regret is separate from the act of apology.
In some public apologies, the words are so detached from any meaning that I could read the text of them aloud over a gentle instrumental and release it as a tranquillusionist. If you're not sure whether you're dealing with an apology or a faux apology, it can help to read the text.
When you're evaluating an apology, whether it's an interpersonal apology, but especially when it's a public apology, I think you need to detach the language that's being used, the actual words that are being used, from the performance of an apology, especially if somebody has spent a lot of time in the public sphere. They're going to be trained on how to perform. And so they may seem very regretful and they may seem very emotional. And a lot of times like that can be genuine, but I also think it's worth thinking about the language that's used and not necessarily the performance. So you can say the right words, but if you say them in an angry tone of voice, then that doesn't seem like a sincere apology. Or you can perform it perfectly and, you know, cry at all the right times and become very choked up when you're talking about these things. But if the speech strategies and actual words that you're using aren't true apology words, then, you know, that doesn't count. And I think people need to think really critically about that.
They also often seem unnecessarily long. And is that sort of like waving something in front of your face so that you're just too exhausted really to concentrate on the finer points?
Well, I think so, because there are a lot of different mitigating strategies that are used. So you'll find that the non-apology strategies are actually a lot longer than the apology strategies. And that's the thing, like a lot of times these faux apologies, they often use some genuine apology strategies.
So watch out, but faux apology characteristics don't necessarily equate to a faux apology.
There's a lot of people that will say, oh, an expression of regret is not an apology. And that's something that you see a lot of times in a critique of somebody's public statement. As soon as somebody says, I regret X, they get critiqued as, well, that's not an apology. And that's not necessarily true. And people can use a lot of faux apology strategies and still have a successful, real apology. It kind of comes down to the balance of it, because in any sort of public apology, you're always going to find faux apology strategies. I haven't come across one that doesn't have at least a couple. It's just if you have more faux apology strategies and, you know, zero explicit expressions of apology, then it doesn't count. But you're always going to have some sort of defense because you are trying to protect your public image. I think that naming what you're sorry for is important. And then the other things are kind of just icing on the cake.
And getting out quickly before you start to pull focus.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that over-apologizing, especially in interpersonal relationships, can make the other person feel like they have a responsibility to forgive you. And so one of the things that people will say in an apology is, I ask your forgiveness. And that's pretty common in formal apologies. I don't know if anybody has the right to ask for forgiveness, because that also puts a lot of onus on the person you're apologizing to, because they have two options. They can either accept your apology and forgive you in order for you to save face, but also it's imposing on them, and an apology shouldn't impose on the other party.
We hate "Can you forgive me?" I'm gonna include you in the "we," Susan.
Oh, all right.
I hate.
Yes.
"Can you forgive me?" Because forgiveness is a gift, and you don't get to ask for a gift. Nobody owes you anything. You owe an apology. They do not owe forgiveness. You know, maybe it's better for you not to expect to be forgiven.
I think part of knowing whether an apology is sincere can't be judged until you see a person's actions in the future. The words that you use can't be the only thing that you're judged on. You also have to be judged on the actions going forward.
It's hard work. I can understand why a lot of people dodge it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, apologies aren't performed in a vacuum.
The Illusionist is an independent podcast supported by you listeners, emotionally and financially. If you want to help keep the show going, there are three major ways. One, become a patron at patreon.com/illusionist, where you also get extras such as behind-the-scenes glimpses and spoilers. Two, if you want to sponsor The Illusionist, or know a company who does, email info@multitude.productions. And three, tell someone else about the show. If a podcast suggesting circumstance arises and you think they might enjoy it, don't wake up your neighbour at 4 a.m. banging on their door shouting, "Hey, try listening to The Illusionist," because I think ultimately that would be counterproductive.
although I appreciate the gesture. Anyway, thanks to you all for being here. It's nice to be back. And now, your reward for still listening right to the end of the show, your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is... Noria. Noun. A device for raising water from a stream, consisting of a chain of buckets revolving round a wheel driven by the current. Try using Noria in an email today. In this episode, you heard from Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Ingle. They are writers and they analyse apologies at SorryWatch, which you can find at sorrywatch.com and on Twitter at SorryWatch. Laura Bodin studies faux apologies. You can read her MA thesis at her website faupolo.gy. That's faupolo.gy. I am on board with the portmanteau faux-pology, in case you were wondering, and I am not at all sorry about it. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. Thanks very much to Sam Pei for lending me his computer so I could make this episode after my elderly laptop died and then... the replacement immediately died straight out of the box. You can find the show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Allusionist Show. If you've written a thesis about something language-related, tell me about it. That's where episodes such as Mount Weasel and Two or More about the word bisexual arose. If you haven't heard those episodes, well, you can find them. You can find all the episodes and transcripts thereof, and the full dictionary entries of the randomly selected words, and further information about each topic if you visit the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.